Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program.
I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times.
This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, Rob Greaves here, and welcome to Listen to Older Voices and Part 2 of the story of Mick Pacioli. In Part 1, we learned that Mick, born in Woolloomooloo in 1955, was brought up in an environment where his father, Jack, was always either on the wrong side of the law or running close. Eventually, with the shooting of a Sydney underworld figure, Jack escaped to Melbourne with his family. Mick, a highly intelligent and motivated young man, finds himself playing around with the edges of criminal life during the 70s, when social change was everywhere. This week, we learned that when his father, Jack, started the Toorak Times, Mick is variously involved in that undertaking, whilst desperately trying to break from his father and form his own life. There are so many, many stories that Mick shares with us, and he's brutally honest about his father and his relationship with him. We pick up now with Mick talking about his first home away from home, shared with a lady of the night and the sergeant of arms of a local bikie club.
First house as a home with a mate Grant, Shannon Devine, one of the local hookers from up in Orange, and Monster, the sergeant of arms of the Furious Curse Motorcycle Club.
That sounds like a bunch that most of us wouldn't want to meet on a dark night. Were they actually like that, or was it an image?
Well, who, the bikies?
Mm.
Yes and no. Nothing like the image that's being portrayed out there at the moment. Criminality was more restricted, I think, to individuals who chose to, you know, do this or that. Mm. But, I mean, to be honest, the codes amongst the bike clubs then, no heroin. You know, there wasn't a real drug issue, and speed hadn't actually raised its ugly head by then. I'll never forget some of them, like the Immortals, the blokes from the Immortals Motorcycle Club. What a fascinating, inquisitive and inventive bunch of blokes they were. They were always up to something clever and sharing, you know. Mm.
So was your life still very much then to just make your dollar where you saw it, or was there a point where you actually went, okay, I think I need to start focusing on, I won't say exactly a career, but an enterprise or a job and actually get something going? Or was it just take the opportunities as they keep coming?
When I moved out of home, I'd been working with my father for over a year, and I'd built up a bit of a bank. So I had the money to move out in probably 6 months. We'd look for work around the area, you know, labouring work, mm-hmm. in the factories around West Melbourne and that. But to be honest, generally weren't interested. We'd always find a way of making a dollar.
Now, you mentioned Dad, and again, we're talking about Jack Pacioli here. Yeah. Some people will remember Jack from his enterprise into the newspaper world. Mm. When did that start?
1972. Well, he'd been in publishing, per se, before that for a while. He had a blower factory, as they used to call them, a phone sales factory up here on High Street, St Kilda, which is now St Kilda Road. You know where Denman Audio is?
Yes.
Above there, that whole top of that building, was his first business in Melbourne.
Right.
And he used to have blowers up there selling advertising for things like Chin Up and the police journals and all that type of thing. Charity mag sales. So,
right,
you know,
right.
There'd be perfectly fit gentlemen sitting behind phones going, yeah, well, I only got one eye and, you know, we need the money and can you give some money to the old pensioners, you know. So, yeah, that's what the blower factories.
That's what they call them, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then one day, apparently, he met this fellow called Clive Cook, who was a ex-editor from News of the World in London at the Toc H.
The very well known hotel. Yes.
Yeah. Jimmy Smythe had it at the time, I believe, and their front Carvery Bar was a place where a lot of different heads would meet, you know, from around town. And any rate, Jack's in there one day, and this Clive called, hello, Jack, why don't we do something and take the piss out of these people in Toorak here, mate, you know? Any rate, they did. So the Toorak Times was born. That's how he got into it. It's just spur of the moment, suggestion. He sort of had an idea about you know, magazines because he was selling advertising, and then just dove head in. Yeah, I'll produce a newspaper. Yeah.
At its best, how good was it?
Circulation wise, the largest was 500,000 a week.
That's significant. Yeah. Especially going back in that period.
Well, there
exactly.
was a million properties in
That's
Melbourne.
Right.
I was distribution manager, mate, at the time.
So you were working with Dad?
On and off over the years, mate. On and off over the years.
Right.
Yeah. On and off over the years is probably the best way to underline it, you know?
Right.
Because, you know, eventually we'd have an argument, I'd piss off, and then 6 months, 3 months, a year later, I'd get the call. What are you doing? Do you think you'd come in and give us a hand for a little bit? Then I'd be trapped for another 6 months or whatever, you know, until we had another big blue. And
it's always hard working with family.
Yeah, well, I reckon I gave him his best ideas.
That I can believe. But
yeah. Never accepted one of them off the cuff.
Did the paper, in your mind, you mentioned it had, you know, significant circulation. Do you think the paper actually ever really contributed something to the community at its best?
At best, the object was to have a dig at the foundations of Melbourne's society. That was what it was established for in the first place. My father, being semi-literate, probably didn't help the matter, and he was the chief editor. And he didn't have a real good idea of design either, and often would cut the budget on both these areas just to make sure he got the paper on the street and the advertisers with a chance of getting something in it. Look, it's difficult to actually pinpoint or say something personally. I can only reflect on what I've heard others say about it. And I think Toorak Times went a long way to actually loosening up or I dare not say destroy journalistic credibility, you know. I mean, journalism never used to be personality based. It was always about the story, balanced, true, you know,
yes,
blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
And now it's become very much a personality based.
Absolutely.
And it was my father and his mob that created that,
right,
I believe.
Right.
It broke down those barriers, loosened the ties of the Fourth Estate. Whether so, that's a good thing or a bad thing, we don't know. But I mean,
it was certainly a different approach.
Yeah, even someone like Stephen Main would argue that he takes a big lend from the Toorak Times, or he did when he started Crikey, you know, the no holds barred.
It might be very easy to sit back now many, many, many years later and look at it and go, well, you know, and these are my words just at the moment, that's a lot of trash. But at the same time, you mentioned it had such a big circulation, and obviously a substantial number of people were advertising through it. Why would that come about if it was, you know, basically pulling the apart? Why did people like it?
It was fascinating facts. See, a lot of the time, Dad wrote, yes, but he also had a lot of ghostwriters over the years. I won't give any of them up.
No,
but there were some major Melbourne journalists that used to ghost Jack.
Right.
He also had a lot of influential friends in the Jewish community. And back then, that community was rather split down the middle too. And like, you're either on one side or the other. And Jack was getting information from one side, you know, like quite wealthy people. And
yes,
their business interests were to destabilise these other quite wealthy people. So they'd use Jack in the meantime, knowing that he didn't really give a rat's.
No, no.
You know, so, and he got the name of a bit of a, you know, a neo-Nazi, anti-Jewish, you know, person, which he never was, you know, which he never was.
Newspapermen meet such interesting people. Right. Newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, hold the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.
Listen to Older Voices. Living History on Ageless Radio.
We've talked about, you know, the Tuareg Times in those days at its best. And it's what we might say at its worst, when things were really grinding to a halt, so to speak. How did that come about, and what effect did that have on him and you?
Yeah, well, just to re-qualify one of the things you said earlier, like the current one, it was a newspaper of sections. So, you know, that gutter journalism really only was part of the first two or three pages, and then John Somerville Smith's column, where there'd be some maybe licentious stuff, but the rest of it had some quite credible reading from orthomolecular surgeons and other people in you know, Liberty Victoria and other human rights endeavours. Major personalities like Molly Meldrum wrote, Ross D. Riley wrote for the paper, John Michael Housen, Frank Housen, you know, like so many, you know, Barry Barmer, Harry D. Marini, I could go on and on and on, mate.
So it's a paper of extremes in some
Francis,
way.
Even, and I won't be unkind, I won't call her the Tuareg hairdresser.
Is it a good learning place for you?
Yes. I was a pretty self-motivated entrepreneur. Like, as I say, in and out of working for Dad, by the time I was 24, I started a shop in Chapel Street, Windsor, called Hedonist, which was, you know, a hippie version of Dad's safari shops, I suppose.
Oh, right, okay.
A second-hand record bar, bongs, and other curiously useful artefacts. Second-hand clothing, bootleg records, you know. So I'm one of the... All this talk about record stores and everything, but, you know, they're all up themselves, mate. They never mentioned Hedonist, you know, in those good old, bad old days of record stores, but I was there.
Yeah. Did you run into some of the issues that other people that I know that ran import shops ran into with the local mobs, you know, the festivals and the...
Yeah, I can still show you. I've got one here still, a festival stopper on, I think it was a Rolling Stones album. I'd have to get it out, but yeah. I've got the actual festival document still here. I kept it all this time, yeah.
Like a cease and desist type thing, is it?
Yeah. Well, Charlie had the Toad Hall bootlegs at the time. Yeah, and I think I've still got one Little Feet one. But yeah, I used to sell them at Hedonist and, you know, like second-hand records of all sorts. And, yeah.
Okay, let's try and bring these things together. Your record shop business was going simultaneously while Dad was running the Times?
Yeah. So, like, I'd started my career working with Dad, you know, in the newspaper, and then on and off, I'd be working for him.
Yeah, whilst working for
yourself. A year's gap or this, you know, he'd have me back in for 3 or 4 months, I'd pick up, you know, another bit of money, I'd be out again, you know.
How long did the Times run for?
From 72 to... I suppose 92 was its the recession we had to have.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it was 20, some 20. That's a fairly good run.
20 years. So yeah. In, you know, all over the place. We had papers in the Gold Coast, in Western Australia, Port Phillip, Mornington Peninsula, all over the place. You know, Walbury, Wodonga at one stage.
So it was more the economic downturn that brought the Times to its knees than a political or...
Yeah, it was. Totally. Recession. And people refusing to honour their contracts.
Mm.
The last people to be paid is the advertiser, mate. You know, the advertising dollar.
Yes.
So, yeah.
How did that affect your dad? Because he must have put an awful lot of himself into it over 20 years.
Well, he did, but being the old man he was, he went out and started just collecting goods on the debt and ended up with these warehouses called Jack the Ripper.
So well,
and he ended up from there. He ended up reinventing his life. This is around the time Mum died. Reinventing himself, like getting Franco Cozzo furniture on consignment and putting it on his floors. You know, like he used to. Mate, there's a few Jack Pesciole laws. You know, one of them's licensed motor trading when he was in the car yards.
Good God.
And the other one's cigarettes from all the, you know, all the semi trailers that used to go disappear. You know.
He always had an angle, by the sounds of it. Yeah. A survivor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, like, he was a boy that took off with his swag at the age of 14, mate, from Bendigo. Him, his swag and his trumpet, took off up the road with his Uncle Ted and ended up getting bushwhacked, lost his trumpet, got bashed, ended up in the cane fields in northern Queensland, right? Came back to St Kilda here, and again with his Uncle Ted, had a bookshop in Fitzroy Street, a second-hand bookshop. But he ended up going to court. One of the early magistrate court appearances was... Well, Ted was a bit of a... he was a house painter, but a bit of a...
bit of a lad?
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, and Ted Rasmussen. And he'd running all the young boys around the area. They're knocking off all the books from the public libraries. Right, to sell them in the bookshop.
I was going to say, surely there's nothing more safe than running a bookshop. How do you get into trouble running a bookshop? Well, you've answered that.
Yeah. And it also answers the question why... probably why libraries have now got stamps all through their books on every other page.
Thanks, Jack.
So, interesting one. That again, the family legend goes that, you know, the magistrate here in St Kilda just got up and go, "You're an evil genius, Pascioli." At 16.
Wow.
He's running this shop. You know, this is after he got back from up north.
What have you inherited from your dad? Other than that laugh.
Yeah. As I'm getting older, his meanness, I suppose, his mean demeanour. I can get a bit cranky at times, you know, especially with my sister, but yeah, I think it might be just her.
Brothers and sisters are always like that with each other. That's not a Pacioli thing. What do you think you actually got out of him? You said, you know, a meanness, but do you think, what did you learn from him that you're applying to your life today? Because, okay, it's easy to look at Jack and go, oh, look, he was a rogue. But on the other side of the coin, he was a successful rogue.
To some degree. He didn't die a rich man. He didn't die. He died with bugger all, in fact. He'd started a new newspaper and he'd sold a quarter of that for $200,000, and he felt he had a buyer out there for $1 million, but this is just as he's dying, and, you know, he's trying to impart this information to me from his deathbed.
Oh, goodness.
And, you know, I was computer illiterate myself at the time, so, you know, I had very little chance of finding all his stuff.
Yeah.
Just the other day, he came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it, and as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad, you know I'm gonna be like you. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon, when you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, you know we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day, he said, thanks for the ball, Dad, come on, let's play, can you teach me to throw? I said, not today, I got a lot to do, he said, that's okay, and he walked away, but his smile never dimmed, said, I'm gonna be like him, yeah, you know I'm gonna be like him. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon, when you're coming home, Dad, I don't know. College just the other day, so much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you, can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys, see you later, can I have them please?
and the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon. Little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. You know we'll have a good time then. I've long since retired, my son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids are the flu. But it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon. Little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. We're gonna have a good time then.
You've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning back time, turning back time, turning back time, turning back time, turning back time.
He was a fantastic ideas man, and I think that's what I got from him. He had the ability to find the, well, really he was the loophole king, you know? I mean, everything from mining all the way through, all the different things, you know, that he did. Because, you know? I mean, when he started off on his little adventures, things he was doing weren't necessarily against the law, Rob. You know, I mean, right. Knocking off semi-trailers or cigarettes was, obviously, but, you know, I mean, yes. That was done by others and he only fenced again.
Yes,
you know, but
yes. So it'd be safe to say he was very good at, if not manipulating them, pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
Of what?
Yeah, and usually they close the boundaries just after.
Yes, after. Yes, whether it was because of him.
Too many complaints or whatever, like consignment cars.
We've listened to roughly 3/4 of an hour to an hour of you talking on and off about Jack, and it seems like it was a very mixed relationship. There were times when you probably despised him, yet he was your dad, and there were times when you must have loved him. What effect did his death have on you?
I think I spun out a little bit after his death. I got a an amazing sense of freedom from being tied to the old bastard all these years, you know?
Yes.
An amazing sense of freedom. But on the other hand, too, Rob, I was there holding his hand when he died. I actually invited him to go and have a dance with Mum, and he took his last breath.
Mm.
So, you know, I've been lucky like that. I was there when my mother died too. So I've been there, on the spot, seen them, you know, virtually take their last breath.
Do you think that that's something you've come to grips with then, this living and dying thing?
Because a lot of people haven't. Yes. Just the end bit, you know, the bit where you come out of a wet hole and the bit where you go back into either a wet hole or a fire, you know. Yeah.
Your life was not over when your dad passed on, and you've still got many years to go now, but what did you move into then after Jack's death? Did you just keep doing the same things you'd been doing, or did that have... you said you had this sense of freedom. Did you manage to move into other things?
Oh, well, mate, I did a bloody lot of other things before then, you know? I mean, I'd been a worm farmer, I'd been a tuna fisherman, I'd been a scallop fisherman, pro fisherman. You know, I had a huge worm farm down in Orbost, and they were going to give me... well, they'd approved $360,000 to give me to enhance and develop the 27 substations all the way to the border and centre them on the Orbost tip with my organic resolutions and a big range of equipment that they were helping me buy. But unfortunately, at the time, that was when I came back to Melbourne to help my father while I was waiting for the finances. My missus started playing up, and rather than go back to Orbost and lay waste to the buggers that were knocking off me wife, I thought I'd just let it go, and the three kids.
How long had you been married for to that point?
Never been married, mate.
Okay, let me rephrase
it. Six wives, never been married.
With the woman we're talking about with the children, how long was that relationship for before you ended it?
It was a bit different. I met Natalie after a 7.5 year celibacy. She's 15 years my junior. So, I mean, I met her, she was 20, 21 when I was 35. And we were together for about 4 years before she fell pregnant, on and off.
So you ended up with four children?
All up, yeah. Three to her and one to an earlier.
Have you maintained a relationship with them?
Oh, yeah.
Is it a good one? Yeah, a close one.
Yeah, very.
In part three, the final part of his story, Mick continues to regale us with tales, including how, amongst all the gangs, his father's legitimate and semi-legitimate enterprises, he manages to get involved in lawn bowls. Then, years after his father's death, he successfully resurrects the Toorak Times, but now as a multimedia electronic newspaper. That's next week, part three of the story of Mick Pacioli. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.